You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Next up on Destination Freedom.
And for me, it was a godsend because here was talking about the history of radio, of black radio, you know, as we may call it now, but also blacks in radio. And if you go back to the history of radio, radio, like television, like film, really is a microcosm or representative of what's happening in the culture of a country or of an entity. So, you know, everything that's good and negative about the history of this country is reflected in its media. And the fact that, you know, there was discrimination, legal discrimination, segregation, is also reflected on the air.
Welcome to Destination Freedom Black Radio Days podcast, a copyrighted program of No Credits Production, LLC. I'm producer-director Donnie L. Betts. I speak with Professor Sonia D. Williams. She is professor at Howard University Department of Media, Journalism, and Film. Professor Williams has written and produced numerous features and documentaries for National Public Radio, Public Radio International, the Smithsonian Institute, and local radio station nationwide. She's won awards, including the prestigious George Foster Peabody Awards for significant achievement for Smithsonian's production and Public Radio International, Black Radio, Telling Like It Was, NPR's Making the Music, NPR's and Radio Smithsonian Wade in the Water, African American Sacred Music Traditions. I speak with her about her book, Word Warrior, The Life of Richard Doohan, creator of the original Destination Freedom. Next on Destination Freedom, Professor Sonia D. Williams. And now, Destination Freedom. Thank you so much for joining Destination Freedom Black Radio Days podcast.
Thank you, Danny. Really appreciate it.
So how are you really doing? You know, that's the thing we need to ask each other today. How are you doing?
Oh, as good as can be expected, and I guess as everyone is dealing with all of the changes over the last year and a half, with the pandemic and then everything that's been going on politically and socially. It's been rough, but, you know, we have to keep smiling and keep moving and, and, you know, just try to stay as positive as possible.
Yes. And what helps is you have an infectious laugh. So that always helps, you know, puts everybody
well,
at ease.
Thank you. Thanks.
Let's talk about you. Let's talk about your background. By growing up, what led you to this form, to journalism and to radio?
Well, you know, I think if I could look back at my teenage self or even preteens, I know that I wouldn't have said that I'd be at this point in my life or what I've done even, you know, a little bit earlier, because I think the blessing was that I have had the parents who I have. My brother and I probably hit a mini jackpot in that both of our parents were really supportive and continue to be today. They just celebrated, by the way, their 70th wedding anniversary.
Oh, wow.
Last month. So, yeah, and we had, you know, a big celebration on Zoom, of course.
Okay, right.
So our parents really were supportive of whatever we, what skills or interests we displayed. But I think that growing up in New York City, and having access to all that the city offered on a cultural and social and artistic, perspective was really wonderful, because my mother in particular made sure that we were exposed to everything, whether it's, you know, going to the Bronx Zoo or going to the Botanical Gardens, which we saw as a waste, kind of like, why are we walking around a bunch of flowers and trees? but I mean, you know, and also now that I look back at it, it was like, oh, no wonder I love being in nature.
Yes,
one of the reasons why I love being in nature. And then on the cultural end, I mean, if there was anything on in dance or in drama or in the movies or, you know, museums, we were there. And our mother and her sister and her best friend, we were like a little tribe of the parents and the kids. And you know, we just kind of went everywhere. I'll never forget that almost every summer we were part of the Shakespeare in the Park, folk who went to see the performances of Shakespeare plays that were free.
Yes.
But you had to, it was an all-day event because it wasn't a paid event and it was free to anybody who wanted to go, you had to show up earlier in the day to get tickets.
Gotcha.
So we made, or my mother and her friends made an all-day picnic of it, where we would go and hang out in the park and, you know, take our blankets and run around and, you know, be kids, and then stand in line to get the tickets. And then that evening, watch the play. And many of us, I'm sure, fell asleep once the play started.
It's a long day.
I mean, it was an event. And I, to this day, I remember that whole day and then watching these plays come to life, many of which we probably didn't get because of the language. But, you know, over time, as it went on and we were exposed to more plays, it became, you know, it started to make more sense. So so that's kind of the environment that I grew up in. And I also knew that from early, I can't tell you what age I was, but I was definitely drawn to music. And for some reason, I thought I wanted to play I wanted to play the guitar for whatever reason. And then I got attracted to the clarinet, and I wanted to play clarinet. So by the time I got to junior high school, there was a really dynamic music program in my school. Herman Ritter.
What borough was this? Were you in the Bronx?
This is in the Bronx.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
So what ended up happening was I got involved with the music program, the band, and to this day, the reason why I play the instrument that I play, which is the oboe, the band leader said, "Hey, you know, we have enough clarinet players, and we're all out of clarinets. But there's this instrument that's like a clarinet called the oboe." And I'm like, "What the heck is an oboe?" He said, "Well, it's a woodwind instrument. It's a double reed and blah, blah, blah." So I said, "Okay, well, I'll do that for a minute until you have more clarinets available."
Right.
"And then I want to switch over to clarinet." That never happened. But that's what got me into music and art in high school, because I ended up taking private lessons and going to Manhattan College of Music or School of Music as a preparatory student, and then dealing with theory and ear training. And I, you know, I joined orchestras and played in bands. It was, you know, music is my first love. So that's what kind of in a long kind of form way got me into radio, because I also listen to radio on a regular basis in the house, you know, with friends. You know, obviously that's how we're exposed to all of the popular songs of the day.
Right.
And so, you know, in a roundabout way, music led me to radio. Radio also became a passion, and there you have it.
Oh, beautiful. Well, in that case, very similar backgrounds with myself as well. The radio, music on the radio led me into doing what I do now too. Same. So I can understand that passion. And I didn't realize that you were so heavily into music. So thank you so much for sharing that. And people, I think sometimes have, I listen to other interviews with you and never even have a chance to touch on more of your background. So I thank you so much for sharing that with us. So we need to know.
Oh, yeah, no problem. In fact, you know, one of the things that when I started in college, I was a music major. And while I didn't necessarily see myself as going into music performance, I was a composition and theory major because I wanted to write music.
Okay.
And all. And so I did that. But the other thing that happened my freshman year in college was I got involved with the campus radio station. And, you know, and that was kind of it. It was like,
yes.
Wow, you can make a living
doing this.
Right.
So, that's so fantastic.
There you have it.
I love it. Well, let's talk about something that I really shaped part of my life too, is your series, along with others, Black Radio, Telling Like It Was. Really delving uh-huh. into the early days of radio and the DJs and the drama series and so on and so forth. Tell us about your involvement with that, the Smithsonian production of Black Radio International, Black Radio Telling Like It Was.
Yeah, that was, this year is the 25th anniversary of the airing of that series. It actually aired nationwide on public stations in 1996. But it really came out of the brainchild of Jackie Gales Webb, who was a producer at the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian back in the 80s and 90s had a unit, and this was part of the National Museum of American History. So there was a unit in that museum that dealt with documenting American history through television and radio documentaries. Jackie worked full-time at the Smithsonian in this unit, and one of the things that she decided and started fundraising for was to do a historical series on the history of blacks in radio. Mm-hmm. From the earliest days, from the 1920s up until the early 90s. And so she was able to, you know, get the funding together, and then she hired myself and another producer to work on this 13 half-hour series of programs on the history. So that's really how that came about. It was her brainchild, and for me, it was a godsend because here was talking about the history of radio, of black radio, you know, as we may call it now, but also blacks in radio. And if you go back to the history of radio, like television, like film, really is a microcosm or representative of what's happening in the culture of a country or of an entity. So, you know, everything that's good and negative about the history of this country is reflected in its media. And the fact that, you know, there was discrimination, legal discrimination, segregation, is also reflected on the air. The fact that there were innovations in the medium, from both a technological as well as a programming side, you get that in radio as well. And you get that in terms of our interaction with the medium. So when Jackie was clear that she had the funding to go forth with this in 1994, yeah, it was in 1994 that we actually in earnest started the research and the process of trying to track down as many of the then alive pioneers in black radio as possible, finding archival tape, that existed both at the Smithsonian and in archives around the country. We even went and found folks who had their own, you know, taped some of their favorite DJs or programs on their own, and, you know, went to private owners to see if we could, you know, use some of their tapes. It was like a year and a half or 2 years of intense but absolutely rewarding research and production to come up with these half hours. So you if you listen to the show now, and or the series, the entire 13-part series, it sounds like, wow, they got all this information together and it's a smooth half an hour program. But we're talking about months, if not years,
yes.
of effort that went into it. And it was really wonderful.
Well, as a documentarian, that's what I really appreciated about it. I mean, many, many years ago, I had opportunity to meet Jackie at a convention, I think, for Black programming. I mentioned that to her. She won't remember me or whatever, but I was like, it's one of the series that, really shaped what I wanted to do and what I wanted to further my career, because it gave me so much information and background. You know, you could read a few things. And you know, about the radio was more about minstrel shows and negative connotations for
right.
Blacks that were part of it, you know, from Amos and Anley and Beulah and all that kind of stuff. So, I wanted to know what else was out there. And then when I found what you and I both know and love is the Richard Doohan's Destination Freedom, that made it even more palatable. But then you look at all the different DJs like you. I started on campus radio as well, too, in Fresno, California. So, when, you know, I listened to, like, oh, yeah, all these DJs, they had golden voices, first and foremost. And then they really knew their audiences and built those audiences up. And they had a huge following because radio was the medium. So once again, I just applaud everyone that was involved with that project for having that now as a resource for Moni, myself, who's into the research and that sort of stuff. But even young people who want to know more about what the medium was and how it evolved into what it is today. So
right. And you know, the great thing is that because this year is the 25th anniversary of the show, of the series airing, one of the things that happened with some of the documentary projects that I worked on, say, in the 90s and the early 2000s, was the internet as we know it now didn't exist.
Right.
Not as we know it, you know, today. So the fact that it was, we designed this to be broadcast, and we had gotten the broadcast rights for this, but we weren't able to get secure the sale rights. So the series was never available for sale, because that would have been a whole nother fundraising and legal experience that we just didn't have the money or the resources to deal with at the time.
Yeah.
But now, 25 years later, you know, for the most part, if you're a researcher and you're looking to find out information about early radio or radio from the 70s or the 80s or even earlier, the 50s and the 40s, in terms of what we collected, I used to know the exact number of hours, but, you know, we're talking about probably 300 or so hours of tape. That, you know, included both original interviews that we did with owners of stations, with managers, with programmers, with DJs, with artists, and then archival tape from actual radio shows. And then anything else that we could gather from stations that is now sitting at the Indiana University's Archive of African American Music and Culture. Mm-hmm. So unless you're a researcher and you can get access to that, the programs that came out of all of those hours of tape and information were just sitting on a shelf.
Okay.
And so one of the things that I knew that, you know, maybe this would be a good entree to get it back out into the world for folks who didn't hear the series back then or heard about it and never heard it, this would be a way. So thank goodness PRX, which took over from public radio and national PRI, said, "Hey, yeah, we think we can do this," and so they've made it available to stations nationwide, and it's available on the PRX site. So, you know, now after 25 years, you can hear most of the series, and that's really rewarding.
We are speaking with Professor Sonia D. Williams, a professor at Howard University Department of Media and Journalism, and also the fantastic author of Word Warrior, a documentary look at the writer and producer of Destination Freedom, Richard Durham. Let's talk about this book now. It's a 2016 Phyllis Wheatley Book Award winner and finalist, and it documents the life of a gifted broadcast dramas and journalism and activist, Richard Durham. Tell me about Word Warrior and why Richard Durham is so important, not only to audio drama, but to activism.
I have to credit Black Radio, telling it like it was, for introducing me to Richard Durham, because one of the shows that I was responsible for writing and producing looked at Black involvement in radio in the 30s, the 1930s, and the 1940s. And while, again, segregation and discrimination limited the number of Black voices you heard on the air at the time, and, of course, many of those voices, if they were on the air, if they weren't musicians and they were in a dramatic production, you know, we're talking about stereotypes. And Amos and Andy, which were actually two white guys,
yes, yes.
Portraying Black characters. But then by the time you finally do get some Black characters, Rochester in the Jack Benny show, mm-hmm. or Beulah on the Beulah show, even Beulah, when it first came on the air, was voiced by a white male actor.
Right.
And then finally, Hattie McDaniel became the voice of Beulah. But the bottom line was that in looking at what was the range of programming that existed in the 40s, and the 30s, the late 30s, and into the 40s. And, of course, Richard Durham's name came up. One of my colleagues at Howard had done some research on dramas, radio dramas, during that period, the so-called golden age of radio. And he and another colleague of mine at Howard said, well, if you're going to look at that period, you have to look at this show called Destination Freedom, and you have to also talk about the gentleman who created and wrote every single episode in that series, and that was Richard Durham. So that's how I was introduced to him. I started doing the research about him, and when I first heard the series, oh, wow, I was like, holy moly, this was on radio in the 1940s, the late 1940s.
Yes.
And it was on a regular basis in Chicago.
WMAQ.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Really dynamic, really professional, high production value, just stellar. And the fact that it wasn't, and maybe even today is not as widely known as it should be, is a travesty. But so when I realized that, it was like, okay, so I'll do a segment for the Black Radio series on Destination Freedom and Durham and his contributions. But then the more research I did into Durham himself, it was like, okay, so he worked in radio. He was a radio dramatist. He was a writer. But before he had gotten into radio, he was a poet. He wrote for the Chicago Defender as a journalist and a feature writer. After Destination Freedom, he got into labor organizing. He wrote Muhammad Ali's autobiography in the 70s. He was a speechwriter for Harold Washington, who became the mayor of the first black mayor of the city of Chicago. And I'm like, poor this guy. How did he do all of this?
I know it.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Totally amazing. At the time that he did it, too. And, you know, I was lucky enough to be able to, as you were, speak with people like Studs Terkel and Oscar Brown Jr. to really knew him well, to talk about him. And Oscar always talked about his labor organizing skills. And he said it was the first time he ever heard of a caucus was through Richard Durham, you know.
Right.
And I love the quote when he says when he would talk to Richard, he said every time he would leave him, he would come back with some fat between his ears because there was so much information that he had to share. So when I read your book on him that went more into detail, I was just fascinated. It's called Word Warrior. It's about the life of Richard Durham. And you talked a little bit just about some of his accomplishments. What else can you say about Richard Durham? The reason why I started doing Destination Freedom was just because of that, because it was not well known. And, you know, I just wanted more people to know about it and more people to know about Richard Durham. But continue on. I'm sorry.
Well, no. I think that you are to be highly commended for, you know, being inspired, not just being inspired by Durham, but also bringing his influence into, you know, to today and to people who may not have ever heard of the 1948, 1949, 1950 series. The thing about Durham was that he, based on his own background, and again, it often goes back to your family influences and then education. And he was, I think, if he had one regret, it's that he never really finished his degree. He went to Northwestern for a while, but it was during the Depression, and he didn't have the resources to enable him to continue on through his degree. But he went on and educated himself anyway, and for him, it was all about looking at the world as it existed, what the inequalities in the world, and how to deal with amplifying those, not amplifying the inequalities, but amplifying the positive aspects of a people and a culture to inspire folks to, you know, really push for social justice and change, positive social change. And I think that whether he was writing poetry, whether he was writing a newspaper article or a feature article, whether he was writing a speech for someone else, or, you know, following Muhammad Ali around the world, literally, so that he could write the autobiography that, you know, Muhammad Ali at the time really, you know, wanted, or at least the people around him really pushed to have.
Right.
So I think that you're talking about a man who was principled, who was dedicated to social change, positive social change and justice. And he used all forms of the media and drama to get that point across, and was inspiring in that, whether you're talking about a Studs Terkel or Oscar Brown Jr. or the other folks who he came in touch with, Harold Washington,
right.
and the many, many, many other people who were touched by him, whether they, you know, were physically or personally touched by him or touched by his work, that he was an inspirational person who I thought, once I started doing the research about his life, should be better known. And he came from, his family was part of the Great Migration. So his family moved to Chicago from Mississippi, but his father was a landowner. And in Mississippi, if you're talking about the early 1900s, that is not a usual thing. You know, but his mother and his father, his father had attended Alcorn State University in Mississippi, and his mother really was an education advocate. She, for all of her children, and they had 8 children, 7 of whom survived into adulthood, she was a teacher. she went back to school when she was in her 60s to get her high school education, and she was valedictorian of her class. I think she and her husband, you know, their children's father, really instilled the whole idea that education is also freedom.
Yes, right.
and is necessary in order for there to be progress, you know, for their children, for the world in general. And so I think that's what helped to shape this man who would then go on to write and create and inspire.
So we are speaking with Professor Sonia D. Williams of Howard University, and we're speaking about her book, Warrior. Can you tell us where the book is available now?
Yes, it is available both on Amazon and Barnes and Nobles. It's actually available almost on any commercially viable book resource.
Okay.
And it's also the paperback.
Right.
But a couple of years ago, literally now in 2018? I was trying to, for what would have been Durham's 100th birthday. He was born in 1917. So I was pushing to try to get an audiobook version of it for his 100th birthday. I didn't quite make the 2017 mark, but in 2018, we were able to get out an audiobook version of the book, A Word Warrior. So that's available as well. And it is on Downpour, which is another service, just like, say, Audible, but it's called Downpour.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Professor Williams. It's been an honor to speak with you. It's been a long time coming.
Oh, yeah.
But we finally get there again. We're speaking with Sonia D. Williams, professor at Howard University, but also the author of Word Warrior, The Life of Richard Durham, a 2016 Phyllis Wheatley Book Award a nominee, and someone who's inspired my life. You both have. Thank you so much for giving me
thank you.
Your time,
really,
and also gave me a little line in the book itself. So I was so honored. Oh my God! I said, "Oh, I'm mentioned in the book." That concludes this episode of Destination Freedom Black Radio Days. I'm producer director Danielle Betts. The 2020 season will examine the issues facing communities of color, exploring police shootings, immigration, health disparities, and gender bias. Support for Destination Freedom is provided by the Bonfi Stanford Foundation, the Ulipians Fund of the Denver Foundation, Arts and Society, and Karen and Johnny Klein. Destination Freedom Black Radio Days is produced by Danielle Betts. The series is remixed by Maurice Smith, a.k.a. Reese. Make sure you check us out at nocredits.com and pick up our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. iTunes, Radio Public, Spotify, etc. Follow us at Twitter at Donnie Betts. Hashtag No Credits Production LLC. Hashtag Black Radio Days. Hashtag Destination Freedom Black Radio Days. Thank you for listening.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.